Welcome to Get to Work Hurley, your podcast for pro writers, fans, and geeks of all sorts. On this episode, she's a Nebula, World Fantasy, Ignite, an Aurora Award-winning Indo-Caribbean scientist and speculative fiction author. She's also been a finalist for the Hugo Ignite Locus British Fantasy and Crawford Awards. Her new book is One Message Remains, now available everywhere. Welcome to the podcast, Premi Muhammad. And now your host, Cameron Hurley.
Oh, boy. So, Premi, we finally got you on the podcast. I'm extremely excited about this. I know that we got this scheduled forever ago, so I was extremely glad we finally did. So, welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the invite. I'm so excited to chat.
Totally. So, I was actually looking, because you're one of those writers who I knew you from short fiction. You've been doing short fiction for, gosh, 10 years, I want to say, a while. But you have, like, really crashed onto, there's been this crash onto the scene the last 4 or 5 years, maybe, of suddenly there's this wealth of amazing work that's really hard to keep up with. I was actually talking to my spouse, and he said, man, I haven't even caught up with all of her stuff yet, because it is just so prolific. I'm wondering, again, what has led to this amazing blossoming of work and longer work, especially it seems to be more novella length than short fiction. So I'm just curious about, your amazing creative outflow and where that has come from, where you're drawn to particularly novellas.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's funny because I did start in short fiction, and that was almost against my will. I actually find short fiction extremely difficult. I think I've talked about this before, but short fiction is like not my natural length. I like to liken it to stride length. So when I was doing environmental consulting, one thing we often had to do was pace out the place we were working so we could do like a little map of what it currently looked like. My natural stride length is well short of a meter, like a yard, which a lot of people of average height, their natural stride length is about that long. So when I paced something out, I would always have to multiply it by about 1.2 to get the actual measurements of the site. And novel is actually my natural working length. I didn't really get into short fiction until a friend kind of nudged me to start doing it in my spare time for pocket money, because after I sold one, I was like, oh my God, they'll just pay you for this. They do, they just pay you. They give you money for writing short stories. And a couple of years later, and you'll be familiar with this, so the peer pressure of making friends with writers and then having them kind of go, hey, you know what you should do? And kind of like nudging you gently in the side while you're trying to drink your beer. They were like, you know where the real money is? Novels. You should see if you can sell a novel. And I was like, well, I don't think that's very realistic. I guess I'll try. So I kind of went through the query trenches briefly, as it turned out. Got the book deal. That was a 2-book deal. So when you're talking about this sort of blossoming, mm-hmm. That's where it started was, oh, I sold a book. That book already exists. Now I have to sell... I have to write another book that has already been sold. What a strange concept. I've likened it to the publishing treadmill. Is once you're on it, technically you can step off, but if you've got contracts on the horizon, you sort of can't, because they'll come after you and they'll sue you or they'll hit you with hockey sticks or something. I am not sure. I haven't broken a contract yet. But that's just what's happened, is we keep getting book contracts.
Mm-hmm. It's a nice problem to have.
Yeah. And the whole, I'm always on deadline. I'm on deadline right now. It does feel like complaining that my diamond shoes are too tight, but it is a lot. Yeah. There are a lot of deadlines. None of the editors are aware of the other editors' deadlines. Things pile up and I am just running flat out on this treadmill. And as you know, authors aren't in charge of their own publishing schedules. Mm-hmm. The book comes out when the press says it'll come out. Mm-hmm. So that's why I had 4 books out last year.
And yeah, they don't really coordinate, to your point. Yeah, all the different publishers don't really coordinate with each other. How many publishers do you have? It must be at least 4.
Probably at this point, six-ish, seven-ish. Yeah, last year it was four separate presses. Yeah. This year, as far as I know, two. And I have two books coming out.
So I can assure you, just as someone who has skipped my deadlines many times, nobody sues you or comes after you or any of that. So don't worry, it's okay. I know you're still the one. Oh my God,
I'm
what did they
shocked.
do to me? So
I am shocked.
no,
Hold on a
it
second.
is.
Can you hold up that coffee mug again? Because that was like the coffee mug from So I Married an Axe Murderer. That's like the gigantic coffee shop coffee mug.
I like these mugs because when people see them on the webcam, they think it's like an angle thing or like a parallax thing. They're like, it can't possibly be that big. And then I hold it up next to my head. No, it is that big. It's important to stay hydrated because you can't write if you're dehydrated.
See, pro tip right there. That's the incisive stuff that everybody's here
That's a craft tip, is
for.
if you are a raisin, maybe you are able to produce fun Motown music with the rest of your band, but you cannot write novels.
There you go. See, and I was just gonna say it doubles as a soup mug, so it's like you can drink
Yeah,
soup
it
out of
does.
it.
I
So
do
you
use them. I like to use them as soup mugs.
one dish. I was gonna say one dish for it all. Once again, streamline your life, right? Make it
Yeah,
easy.
efficiency. Efficiency is key.
Excellent. Okay.
Wait, this is going to be extensively edited, I assume.
No, no, no.
That
Tim
would
will edit himself, so he'll read you all of his stuff, although he sounds great. You and I,
No,
he's
this
just
is
going to
all
be brilliant.
gold. This is we're
Yeah.
spinning gold here.
This is writing gold right here.
Yes.
No. So you say, you know, Rumi, you say that again, short fiction isn't kind of your natural mode, but you do work as an assistant editor at Escape Pod. I'm curious. And I know I've certainly found this working with junior writers and editing their work that it's taught me a lot. So I'm curious if that role and you know reading slash and editing has changed your approach to craft in any way and how you feel that it has influenced you doing that kind of
Oh
work.
God, that's such a good question. Yeah, I didn't really realize what was happening at first, or I wasn't doing it consciously. I think the big thing that reading slush sort of gives you, like immediately, especially if you're reading a lot of it. And before I was an assistant editor, I was an associate editor, so that was at the like slush end. Assistant editors, we get the stuff that the slushers pass up. So I'm kind of like middle management now, but I didn't start there. After you read, you know, 500 stories or whatever in a month, what starts to jump out at you is patterns. And you can't really see that if you've only been reading, I guess, A, either published stuff that has already been through the whole process, or B, just like a handful of unpublished stuff. It's not until you get to like the 500th story where you're like, okay. So, in terms of topics, I can see that there are things people want to write about because they are apparently in the zeitgeist or something. I can see that there were 10 people who read the same article on Popular Mechanics and they all decided to write roughly the same story. And we're not buying one of those because none of them did kind of anything unusual or fresh with it. You know, we're seeing the same patterns of people being sort of thoughtlessly or carelessly bigoted or misogynistic or ableist, things that have kind of soaked into them that they've never really questioned, and then it shows up in their writing, and you're like, well, we can't buy this. What are you doing? And after a while, you stop being surprised by things. But I think the main thing it taught me was to look for what patterns could be emerging in my own work. You know, was I doing some of the things that we were letting writers know that they were doing? Was I introducing those thoughtless isms into my own work? Or was I just doing minor craft things like, oh, these two are doing a talking heads thing. They are exchanging information. This is still an info dump. Just because you put quotation marks around it doesn't not make it an info dump. Editors are not fooled by you trying to break up your info dump into two people giving the dump. Am I doing that? You know, am I starting my stories too late? Am I using the wrong characters? Are these people interchangeable? Could I swap out any of them and the story wouldn't change? Is this ending earned? Does it make sense? Is it logical? Is it emotionally satisfying? If it's not, did I do that on purpose? And just seeing all the things that, eventually dozens or hundreds of people were doing, and then their stories weren't getting bought. Eventually, I was like, oh, you know what would be smart is if I applied some of this to my own writing. Imagine what a concept. But yeah, I think that was my big takeaway, and that took me a while to figure out was seeing patterns. Not that
Pattern.
one person was doing something, but like dozens of people were doing something.
I also found for short fiction, I've been doing a short story a month on Patreon for like 10 years. And what I also found that exercise really good for is learning structure, because the issue with novels is you only finish so many, so you don't get that experience of doing structure over and over and over the same way that you do with short stories. So with a short story, you could then analyze it and go, okay, beginning, middle, end. Beginning, middle, end, beginning, middle, end. And it is, it's like you do that enough times, and to your point, it's like now I can kind of see those patterns, whether it's in yourself
Yes.
or in someone else, because you have done, that repetition so much. How much short fiction have you written?
Oh boy. Like a lot. The weird thing, I think, and I was just talking about this yesterday with a friend, is right around the time that I figured out that I could be fine-tuning my short fiction to be better based on the things that I was seeing as patterns in the escape pod slush pile, was when I stopped submitting short fiction to venues for possible purchase. I didn't have time because, oh, my diamond shoes, because I was getting solicited too often. I was just talking about this in a Patreon post too. Like last month, like January 2025, I handed in four solicited short stories. That's 23,000 words. I don't have time to write my own short stories anymore. I am writing short stories for other people. So whether or not any of my brilliant conclusions or craft learnings can be employed in the real world, I haven't found out. My last maybe 30 published short stories have all been solicits.
I can actually answer the question. There are 77 short stories, some of which
Thank
are
you.
reprints, but to me, that's like, well, it's just as good as the first time around, but 77 published stories plus reprints.
That is astonishing. No,
Thank you, Kim.
Sure. I just happen to have that
Kim is
information
so
at hand.
organized.
Just happen to have a spreadsheet with that information.
Should be 78 now because I just had one out like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, okay. I'll add that to the
Yeah.
spreadsheet.
Yeah. You do a lot of speaking engagements and guest writer gigs and stuff like that. I'm wondering, and you were just that writers in residence last year at Edmonton Public Library. I'm curious how much of this is coming to you that you're getting solicitations, or how much are you actually going out and kind of pursuing those? Is it just a matter, it's just kind of happened organically as you've been going to other events, people invite you. How's that process?
Yeah, that seems to be a lot of it. Certainly last year, a bunch of the invites that I got for events later in the year were people referencing that they had either seen me speak or somebody dropped my name or something at something earlier in the year. I think one of my favorite ones was I got invited to When Words Collide, which is a local con here, and that was scheduled for August. And the organizer was like, yeah, I actually heard you give the keynote at something virtually in February. And I thought, I wonder if she wants to do a keynote for us. I was like, oh my God, thank you. Because, the organizers didn't tell me anything. And you've obviously done a lot of this too, but it's like you do the thing and then it's just kind of radio silence afterwards. You don't get feedback, you don't get people saying, hey, I loved your talk or I loved your class, or you might get that after the actual thing, but afterwards it doesn't have that kind of tail of people being able to pick it up and read it like a book. So it's got a shorter lifespan. A lot of that, yeah, has been people reaching out or reaching out to my agent or a friend of a friend, things like that. And yeah, last year I did 13 events. So If it had been up to me, I would not have solicited so many of those. Like, I wouldn't have been asking to do 13 events, and I probably should have said no
I
to
was just
several
gonna
of
say,
those.
you know you're allowed to say no, right?
Yeah, I felt like I couldn't. I was the writer in residence. I felt like I also had to represent the city of Edmonton as an ambassador. I felt I had to do what my publicists were asking me to do and talk up my books.
Yeah.
Like, six, I think, of those events, five or six of those events were organized by my one publicist at ECW Press, God bless her. But yeah, part of me was like, I'm gonna go, but I don't think this is going to sell books, and I can't tell, because this is the other problem with publishing, is if something does move the needle, unless you're self-publishing, you don't really see that happen in anything close to real time. You get your email with like your PDF and the royalty statement like 6 to 10 months later.
Yeah, and it's hard to say. And again, to your point, I talk to writers about this all the time. Like, do I have to go to cons? Do I have to go to events? And it's like, no, you don't have to. But the thing is, it helps, right? Because then you meet people, and people have heard of you, and it's oh yes, I saw you
That's
speak
the real
at that
use
thing.
of it. Yeah.
Exactly. And
Is
it's
getting
not
to meet people, getting to
necessarily,
say hi to people. Yeah.
yeah, it's not necessarily about selling the books, right? It's about those relationships, which I hear all the time, too, with bookstore events, right? It's the same thing. You go, I sold 10 books, whoop-dee. But they said, but you made a great relationship with readers, with
Yep.
booksellers, with
Yep.
other professionals you get to go out and hang out with. So it is funny
Exactly.
because, to your point, there's no tangible, you can't immediately see that
Yeah.
tangible reward the way that you can with, yeah, I just sold 20 books on Amazon today with a tweet.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Well, the other great thing about bookstore events, of course, is that you are in a bookstore. So you may have
Yes.
sold 10 of your own book, and then you can just kind of turn around and like leave with a gigantic tote bag full of books because you're like, oh, I wanted to buy that one. Oh, I'll just take that one. I'll buy that one. I'll buy that one. I can tell from your office that you have a book problem like me.
Yep.
Most of my books are in the living room. This is the small overflow into the office. That doesn't include the overflow into the bedroom or the hallway or the basement.
We could be doing drugs or have some
Exactly.
other horrible.
This is a very innocent vice.
That's what I tell myself. I could be doing so many other things
You
and
can do
wasting
those at the same
my
time. You don't have to make a choice. You can do all the things.
That's a good point. And I think a lot of the writers of the 60s and 70s showed us that you can do
Yes,
drugs
exactly.
and write books,
And write books amazingly. Yeah,
depending on
shockingly.
the drugs, because
Don't
like I
limit
think some of them just kind of
yourself.
like knock you out, and then you
You'll
can't write. But if you're on like coke or something, or like crack,
be up
you can
all
write
night.
lots of books. Yeah,
Right.
yeah,
Worked
because they're
for
not on
Aaron Sorkin for many
stimulants.
years.
Yeah,
That's it.
exactly.
And I will say, speaking of being up all night, so you actually started writing, or at least some of this was, I know you talked about some professional burnout that you had been through, just with other things that you had done. And I'm curious how you felt like, how like that professional burnout perhaps affected your embracing writing to the extent that you have. I'm just wondering if there's any kind of correlation or learning that you had from that, where I have professional burnout and then I've moved to this. If you want to share any of that.
I found out that professional burnout also happens if you are doing your hobby. So, for almost all of my life, I was writing for fun. I was writing for myself. Nobody else ever read it. And I wasn't writing with the goal of getting published. Like, that wasn't the point. Similarly to how when my friends and I played tennis, we weren't doing that to try to get into Wimbledon or something. We were just playing it because it was fun and it was something to do after school. And it kept us from doing buckets of drugs, which we couldn't afford anyway. But you know what I mean. That was writing for me. It was something I did for fun and to relax. And when I started selling short stories, that was still manageable because short fiction is something that nobody is waiting for. You can just do it kind of in the corners of the day. And then when your story's done, you can be like, okay, let's see who's gonna buy this maybe. And there's no pressure, there's no deadlines. It wasn't really until I got into kind of the contract treadmill, and then they were starting to kind of pile up to the point where I was having to hand in two and sometimes three books per year, alongside the short fiction, alongside trying to perform properly at my real job, that the burnout really kind of started. And yeah, in 2023, 2022, 23, it kind of reached as bad as I realized it was going to get. I was like, it was starting to affect my health. My doctor suggested going on disability, and I probably should have given him a chance to actually finish all the paperwork and stuff. Instead, I was like, I will call you back. And I hung up, and then I quit my job.
Oh my gosh, wow.
Yeah, and I have never done that before. I'm a very, very risk-averse person. I've never left a job without having another job lined up to start in, a couple of weeks or something. I was absolutely a wreck emotionally, physically, mentally. I couldn't sleep. I had anxiety. I had depression. The first couple of weeks were just a haze of like sobbing and doing laundry and trying to remember how to be a functional human being. And I look back at that time, for the 3 or 4 months after I was trying to recover and job hunt and meet my deadlines, and I was like, I was still handing stuff in. I don't recall how I was doing that. Sometimes I would get something back for edits and be like, yeah, this isn't bad, but who wrote this? Like,
Yeah, I don't
I don't
remember.
remember writing this. I wrote this in a fugue. I would have made some different decisions if I had been 100% there. And I think that's what burnout really does to you, is it takes you from yourself. It means that you're not 100% there. You've dug so deep, you finally hit the end of yourself, and you're in like the bedrock now, and your shovel's starting to get blunted. And I wasn't the writer I could have been. I wasn't the person I could have been. I wasn't the friend. I wasn't the employee. And the thing that really bugs me, of course, is that that had been the case for like a year and a half before I quit. Then in 2024, I discovered that, yeah, I was the writer in residence for the library. I had 4 books out. I had 8 short stories out. I was also handing in and writing short stories the whole time and finishing books and doing edits and also going to 13 events and doing teaching and speaking. And I was like, oh, I thought this would be fun because it's writing. No, this is terrible and I am dying. And I am really, really not out of that place yet. And I find that it's kind of both hideously embarrassing and painful to be this vulnerable about it, but also it helps to talk about it because it helps to kind of codify what I'm feeling, which is, I thought this was what I wanted to do. It turns out only some of this is what I wanted to do, and some of it is some stuff that I should be saying no to or postponing if I can. In terms of my creativity, it feels like looking at the sun. I almost don't want to think about how it's affected what I'm writing, the choices I'm making in my writing, whether I'm, pulling my punches or swinging weakly at things that I, should be swinging harder at. When I felt myself mostly recovering, I think around like October or November last year, I handed in a really unusual story, a solicit to an anthology with a very broad theme, and it was non-linear, and it was almost like a Rashomon story. So it was 7 different points of view talking about what appeared to be the murder of someone, a wizard, who who really, frankly, let's just say it, deserved murdering. So, the medical examiner gets to have his 500 words or whatever is his 600 words. One of the man's daughters gets to have his, her words. The man himself, who is now in hell, gets to have his. A demon gets to have his. The dog who was there in the room gets to have his. The canal that he fell into out of the window gets to have his. And I was like, oh, I'm having fun writing part of a short story from the first person point of view narrative of a canal below a wizard's tower. That's very strange. This isn't like a standard short story. I was having fun again, and I was pushing myself and challenging myself and trying to make sure that the story, when you rearranged it, still had a linear beginning, middle, end. And I was like, okay, that is not something I could have written like a year ago. I would have just gone the safe way, I think, and written a much more boring, simple story, and I would have handed it in, and I would have been like, that's fine, but I'm happy that I wrote this,
Yeah. No, and I think burnout is one of those things that is very hard, to your point, because you think, well, now I've gotten everything that I wanted, right? Now I got everything that I wanted, so why isn't life perfect? Why isn't And it is. I remember I've been in a very similar state a couple of times. I think 2014 was the first time, and 2020, 2022, really. Also, so like I am feeling those vibes. What it is, like eventually you have to say no because it becomes you. And that what you just said about I forgot what I even wrote. I feel that so hard. It is. I'll read things and I was like, I realize I'm not even. Why am I doing this if I'm not even enjoying it? And it wasn't even it's not enjoying it, but to your point, that I'm writing something that challenges me or that levels me up or something like that. And you can't do that with burnout. And I think it is, as you said, there's something about we are operating on the lowest setting. So it's one of the
Yes.
simplest story, yeah, that I can
Yeah.
do. Whereas when you're starting recovery, as you had said, you're starting recovery now. It's like, oh, I can start connecting the dots a
Yeah.
little bit
It
more.
felt like some gears had caught or something. You
Yes.
know, like if you're pedaling in the wrong gear, you can be working as hard as you can and nothing happens. And I think that's what burnout kind of felt like to me, was I'm putting in 3,000% more effort. I'm running out of every possible resource that I have, and the work isn't showing it. And then when things catch again, when you engage again, and when you engage with your writing and with yourself and with your editor and with your readers again, you can almost hear it like clunk. Oh, like my chain wasn't on or whatever, you know. And now I'm pedaling and I'm moving forward. I get it. Yeah. So I'm gonna see if I can preserve that feeling for this year. I am very, very uncomfortable being unemployed. And I know some people will be like, you're not unemployed, you're a full-time author. I'm like, what is the
No, I feel you. Yeah,
I
absolutely.
am not having a good time.
100%. Yeah. No, you think it's going to be the best thing in the world. And it's, in fact, it's
No.
extremely economically precarious, right? It's
It's very
extremely
precarious.
precarious.
It's
Yeah.
I can't deal with this level of precarity after 25 years or whatever of working in science and just getting like my paycheck every 2 weeks. No one here is having a good time except for the cat who's like, oh, big friend is home all the time. I'm like, yeah, I'm home all the time. I'm a bum. What you?
I got everything I wanted, and it sucks, and it sucks. Yeah.
I never wanted, I literally did always assume that I was going to write around my job.
Yeah.
I didn't think there would come a point where that wasn't possible. I did not quit my job to be a full-time writer. I quit my job because I burned out. Because I'm very good at math, as a scientist, I'm good at math. And I was like, I am not making enough money to live off of. The amount of money that I made off my writing the year that I quit was like a month and a half worth of my real job's wages. I was like, why would I try to become a full-time writer? That's a terrible, ridiculous idea. And I'm single. I don't have like a spouse's income to like cushion me if I fall, and my parents can't help out, my family can't help out, so it's me paying all the bills. Thanks, cat. Sorry.
It is really difficult. And again, as you had said, I'm curious. Again, the first time, the first burnout was, okay, I realize I have, like, literally your doctor had to come to you and say, like, you're dying, please stop. But like the second time, like, are you more aware of it now? Are you more aware of it that second time? Were you, because of that first experience, and you did see it a lot more clearly, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. It's sort of, I think it's almost like having like cyclical depression or seasonal depression or something. The first couple times you're like, oh my God, I am dying. What's happening? Because you don't know. And then after that, you start to recognize the signs and the symptoms. And if there's, intervention available, the longer it goes on, the quicker you're able to intervene. So this year I am actually saying no to things. Shockingly, horribly. I am setting aside time to do things like non-screen activities. I am digging up the boxes in my house that have been untouched since the move, with my like hobby stuff in them, like my paints and my canvases and my cross stitch stuff. I'm trying to rebuild those parts of myself that got burnt up and turned into ash over the last couple years. And I haven't actually started, but I'm looking forward to it. I'm reading more too, because like
Yeah.
during the worst parts of my burnout, I couldn't read. And that was really unpleasant because I like reading and I like books and I like writing books.
And when your hobby becomes your job, it's like you have to find another hobby. So yeah,
Yes.
digging out the
Yeah.
cross stitch, digging out, the
Yeah,
paint.
like I can't write for fun anymore. There's no time. I am writing stuff for other people, and it's like I can feel them breathing down the back of my neck, like, where's my story? Oh my God. God, dude, I have 3 weeks to hand that into you. Okay. Okay, so you can stop staring at me now. I'm working on it. But that's the problem when you sell, the story and then the person's waiting for it. It's different than when you write the story and submit it.
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot more pressure. No, absolutely. Because I, girl, I've been in your shoes. Like everything you're saying, I'm like,
Yep, the
oh, that's
nodding.
why I stopped
It's too
zooming
bad
out of those ones. And yeah.
it's too bad this is a podcast. Like nobody can see like the
And the
nodding
nodding, yeah, I know that we're
that's
doing
going
wrong.
on.
Yeah. So you've mentioned your cat, and this is one of the very serious questions that I got from my Patreon subscribers. How much editorial input does your cat get on all of these stories? So.
He gives a lot of input. For example, you should put a cat in that. Have you considered making a cat the main character instead of a wizard? Have you considered making a cat the murder suspect? A very handsome cat, maybe, with gray fur. Unfortunately, our artistic visions are not really in alignment. Which I've had to explain to him. And I usually tell him, go back to writing your screenplay, because you said you were almost done when I adopted you. That's
And
why I
someone needs
adopted
to make
him.
money, okay, you
And
bum.
someone needs
Somebody
to
needs
make
to
money
make some
around
money.
here. And he spent about, 2.5 years telling me he's almost done this screenplay. And when he sells it, we're both gonna live high on the hog. Again, that's how he scammed me in the shelter. He was like, I just need somewhere quiet to write for a couple weeks because I'm almost done this screenplay. So I took him home. Still waiting. Sorry, he's just off camera now with my new setup.
All good. Well, cool. Yeah,
What's the cat's
those are
name?
questions. Oh yeah, Tim.
What's the cat's name?
Fiasco.
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 Yes.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Sorry, I'm like, I love how we didn't actually talk about the book.
Oh yes. Tell us about your book.
the next book, podcast for talking about the professional so I will say this is we can do a segue, which is where did had you found your joy back by the time you finished this book, or was this another book where you were still working on it, and how did you then approach the process of writing this book? And of course you need to tell us what it's called, what it's about, so you can mix it all in there with a nice little segue like that. How's that?
Good segue. Thank you. Yeah, no, the book is called One Message Remains. And the timing, now that you're thinking about it, is really interesting. This was almost at kind of the cusp, I think, of where I thought I was really burning out and wanted to come out of burnout. And I thought maybe this could be kind of one of the vehicles to kind of push me out of that really, really bad, numb, kind of dark creative space where I thought I wasn't doing my best work or good work or like creative work, I guess. Because so to start with, they solicited me, my agent. They were like, hey, what's up? Have you got a novella to give us? We're starting a novella imprint. And I was like, I don't have any just like sitting around. I did have a novella idea, something that I intended to keep at the novella length. And when they approached me, Psychopomp, the publisher, I was like, oh my God, you have just solved one of the problems of this novella idea, which is where to set it, like the where and the when. Because they were asking if we could bundle the novella together with one of the short stories that the Deadlands had published, The General's Turn, which was in 2021, a story that I loved. And of course, because it's a short story, you can only sketch in so much of the world, so much of the setting. And you kind of expect the reader to do the rest. And I was like, I could world build a little bit more if I had another piece of writing to world build with. So I got going on the novella. And then Elise Tobler, my editor, popped back in and was like, what if we made this into like a mini collection? Do you think you can give us two more longish short stories, again, set in the same world? They don't have to be connected, but it'll be a shared universe anthology. And I was like, oh my God, yes. Thank you. And then, again, it was like you could hear the gears catch. You could hear kind of the pilot light, that kind of popping noise. You could hear the pilot light pop on. Oh my God, I have an idea for this other story. And then there was kind of a throwaway line in the General's Turn about the people who make the bone gallows where they hang prisoners of war. And I thought, oh God, bleh, ugh. That's so unpleasant. You really shouldn't do that for a living. And if you do that for a living, how many people are they hanging? So that became the last story that I wrote for it, and it was so, yeah, it was so much fun to kind of delve into this world, to kind of pick what I was talking about and pick what I was not talking about and was just implying so that the reader could be bleh instead of me. I felt a level of, I was about to say accomplishment. I don't think I mean accomplishment, just a level of s satisfaction, I guess, with the way the writing was going, the way things were fitting together, kind of the way the puzzle pieces fit. And so when I handed in the novella and the two new stories to Elise, I was like, I don't feel like I pulled my punch. I feel like I was hitting with my full weight from the hip, or I don't feel like I was trying to like bunt. I feel like I swung really, really hard. I feel like I swung for the bleachers. And I hadn't had that feeling for a while. So my thinking was kind of, hey, it's okay if Elise is like, oh my God, these are shit, or rips them apart in edits. That's actually okay, because they right now look and sound the way I want them to look and sound. And that hasn't been the case for a while. So I'm thankful to this book for letting me do that creatively, even if it doesn't sell. I don't care anymore.
We were talking with Madeline Ashby last month, and she had said something, and I had just finished a book recently too, and she said, that first draft really is for yourself, right? And it's like, and I remember, yeah, having this very incredible sense, like, even if this is shit, I said what I wanted to say, right? I gave it everything that I had, and that was the draft that was for me. And afterwards, then, yeah, we make it for
Yeah,
editors and readers. To your
which is
point, they
fine.
don't go sell it, and that's fine. But wow, no one can take away that feeling, right, that you just had, which is,
Yeah.
holy shit, I didn't pull my punch, which is amazing.
Yeah. And this was something I talked about to people at the library a lot last year. Some people have been working on their novels or their stories or their memoirs or whatever for a really long time. Like, I hate to say it, but like longer than the average genre writer would let themselves panic over it, like 7 years or 10 years or something that they've been working on this one novel. And it's like, I don't want to say you have to stop being precious about this, because you can be as precious about your work as you want. But I am going to say, in your first draft, what you are capturing is your passion and enthusiasm and your fire for the idea, for the characters, for the emotions. You're never going to be able to recreate that in edits. So you have to work to preserve as much of that as you can when you edit your own stuff. For some of the things that I'm looking at, you're on like draft 27 by this point. You've probably gotten a long way away from what excited you about writing the book in the first place, and that's why you can't finish this revision. You have knocked all the life out of it. It's so important to respect that first draft, even if it's incomplete, even if it's not structurally sound, because you can't start the buyer again under the excitement to write that idea. And that also applies to ideas where we sold it on proposal, or we sold just the idea. I tell the story about The Butcher of the Forest, which came out last year in February. Oh, happy 1 year anniversary, little
Here you
book.
go.
Yeah. I'd had this weird dream, and I thought it would make an interesting, I thought at the time, maybe short story. So I tweeted about it. I said, I think the next thing I'm working on is going to be kind of like Escape from LA meets Edmund Spenser's Fairy Queen. I was joking, and several people wrote back, ha ha, I'd read that. And one person said, I would like to read that when you're done it. You should send it to me. And I was like, oh yeah, well, who the fuck? Oh, backspace, backspace, backspace. That was the acquiring editor at Tor. So yeah, at that point I was like, oh, I do, I A, want to finish this, but B, now I feel like I have to finish this. So I did finish it, and then and I had that whole, that excitement, that energy, that dreamlike, illogical sense of a fairy story, of a dream. Then I handed it into my agent, like very unexpectedly. He had no idea that I was writing this book. And I had to screen cap that tweet, because otherwise he would have thought I was a maniac. He's like, we're sending this to Jonathan Strahan at Tor. I'm like, I can explain. He said it was okay. He actually DM'd me afterwards. Just, can we send this to him before we send it to anybody else? Is that okay? He's like, well, considering that this came out of nowhere, like, yeah, I'll send it to him. But then after that, you and I are going to have a talk about working on other books while you were on deadline for a different book. Because this isn't the first time that's happened. So we sent it to Jonathan, and he bought it. And I was like, right place, right
Yeah.
time.
Yep.
But yeah, I finished that novella very, very quickly because I didn't want to lose that sense, and I didn't want to hammer out that first draft energy too much in edits, because that's something I do, is I revise things for a long time if I'm allowed to.
Then you forget. Yeah, and I love what you said. Yeah, about maintaining that energy and that white hot heat, because it's something that I think we give newer writers, like debut writers. We're so excited about how their energy and passion and freshness, and then we beat it out of them, right? We beat it
Publishing is
out of
like,
them. Like,
yeah,
oh yes,
they're like, we're gonna put you between two
yeah,
pieces of plastic wrap, and we're gonna hammer you with this meat
right? And then I go,
so
where's
that you
your
cook for
passion?
everybody. Yeah.
Where did it go to, like, you've literally beaten it out of me
I am so sorry, but you have turned your
yeah.
entire debut class into Wiener Schnitzel. That's what happened. Why are you shocked that this is happening?
It's almost like let's go, and then we gotta go, and then we gotta
Yeah,
smooth out, because yeah, the more
pretty
you say, yeah,
much.
good point.
But
No, that's
yeah,
great.
I'm excited about One Message Remains. It's an unusual format. It's a mini collection. It's a novella and three short stories. It's an unusual length. It's about 55,000 words. It turned into like a decently sized
Oh yeah.
little book, but it's not like a doorstopper epic fantasy or anything. And I hope people see what I was trying to do with it. In terms of trying to write about war and colonialism and resistance and compliance in like a very, very small scale. These aren't people who are out there building barricades in the streets. These are people who are changing the blueprints on their gallows. These are very small stories. This isn't War and Peace. I love War and Peace, to be clear, but that's not a book that I'm going to be able to write. I'm zooming in kind of in this book, so I have people, pick up what I'm putting down. That's always the hope with a book though, right?
Yeah. Again, it's you're reaching out to somebody and saying, you want to make a connection, right? Over time and space, time and space. I'm excited for this one, because Siege of Burning Grass was just that, again, like sometimes you
You.
read a book and it just, again, you vibe with it so hard. And I read that and I just, oh, this is amazing. So I'm super excited for this one.
Awesome, thank you. And yeah, I can see from your decor that you would be on Team Wasp. You're not even on Team Aliphret. You're like, I hope all the wasps do really well.
No, that one was amazing. I love that one so
you.
much. All right, just to be respectful of time, Tim, you wanna wrap us with our final question here?
Sure, it's pop culture pop quiz time when we ask, what are you reading? What are you watching? What are you listening to? Premi, you can go first.
I'll go first. I have been listening to a lot of Florence and the Machine lately. I've just had like her albums on repeat for the last couple weeks while I'm working on this book, and I think it's exactly what I need right now, is someone who just does not give a shit about knuckling under and being nice and making herself small and palatable, because those are not things you can say about her, which I love. I think that's the energy I need right now. What am I watching? I'm not really God, I'm not really watching anything. I did sign up for Apple TV during that free promotion, so that I could watch, what is it, the dinosaur series? I'll have to remember what the actual series is called. The paleontology series. So I was watching that up until a couple weeks ago, but now I'm on deadline. And yeah, I've been reading a lot of stuff to blurb, so I can't really talk, I guess, about it. I can say people are going to lose their marbles for The Library at Hellebore by Cass Kaw, which is maybe the darkest, most gruesome, bloody entrails and viscera everywhere, dark academia that I have ever read. Like, oh, there's a murder. There's two murders in the secret history. Ooh, how terrible. Yeah, no, this is operating at another level. I'm also really enjoying Notes from a Regicide by Isaac Fellman, which is coming out in, I want to say, April. And I also really just enjoyed The Winter Night by Jess Battis, which is not an Arthurian myth retelling, but a whole new story about the questing beast using modern Arthurian descendants. It's hard to describe. I really had a good time with that book, so that's what I'm up to.
Amazing. Yeah, jealous of all of those. Yeah. What am I reading? I'm reading a lot of nonfiction because I'm deep in getting ready to write. I'm in the process of writing another book. So I'm actually reading Emperor of Rome by Mary Beard. Mary Beard is amazing. Just the way she talks about history is just, again, it's that everyday history. She makes the stories about it, and she makes it feel like you're actually really there, which I really love. So yeah, I'm reading that one from her. And I'm told I need to watch also on Apple TV something called The Gorge, which is about two assassins who are on the opposite side of a gorge guarding whatever is in there. And it's like this horror sci-fi mashup. And I'm told that that is amazing. So I am
I'm
going to
also being
that one.
told I have to watch that.
Yeah.
I've heard from friends, this is your thing. I'm like, are you
Yes.
sure? Now, sorry. And I'm also looking up what the name of the series is because now it's going to bug me. Prehistoric Planet.
There we go. Prehistoric Planet. Yeah. Check that one out too. Cool. Well, thank you, Primi, so much. It was an absolute joy to have you on finally. If I have not already pre-ordered that book, I think I need to double check, and I will go and pre-order that one. I'm extremely excited. So yeah, no, I'm Tim, you wanna give everybody the deets?
Yeah, you can find Premi at www.premimuhammad.com on the Blue Sky. What's your handle there, Premi?
It actually is the same as my website. So premimohammed.com,
And then
and I am
also
on
on.
Instagram at premisaurus.
There you go. And of course, Cameron is at CameronHurley.com and active on Blue Sky and Instagram under the same name. If you're listening to this, guess what? You can also watch this video and more at Patreon. This is an exclusive video to Patreon. It's not just for everybody. You have to be a member of the you got to join Hurley's Heroes to get the short, gooey adventures from Cameron every month. So, Cameron, send us home.
All right, everybody, get back to work.